Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily, and these days more than daily, politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls, and I'm joined by James Forsyth and the New Statesman, Stephen Bush. And we have just had the final debate of the election campaign on primetime TV with the BBC leaders head-to-head. We had Jeremy Corbyn going up against Boris Johnson. Jeremy Corbyn went first with his opening statement. James, what do we learn from today's debate?
We learned from today's debate that Boris Johnson wants to turn every question to the issue of getting Brexit done, and Jeremy Corbyn wants to come back to austerity at every possible opportunity. It was a fairly predictable debate in that way. I think both leaders were better than they were in the first ITV debate, but I don't think there was any moment that is going to change the game in this election. I feel rather sorry for the people who are left with having to clip this debate for the 10 o'clock news tonight, because there's not a huge amount in it to take out. And I think you saw from Boris Johnson kind of predictably relentless message discipline on the get Brexit done message. But I don't, this debate hasn't changed the parameters of this election. So all comes down to the question of, if you think the polls are right when they point towards a working Conservative majority, it was a good night for the Tory party. If you think that the polls might be missing something, then it's less certain, because it wasn't, certainly wasn't a knockout blow. Boris Johnson didn't, you know, disprove Jeremy Corbyn's fitness to be Prime Minister tonight or anything like that. And he wasn't really trying to do that. He was instead just trying to hammer his own messages in a way that you would if you thought you were ahead of a game.
Yes, you mentioned clips there, and I'm racking my brain as to which clips, if any, our podcast producer Cindy Yu should be discovering this evening. Stephen, what stuck out for you from the answers from each politician?
So actually, for me, the most interesting, and actually the only answer I felt was genuinely revealing, was because the audience questions were, in my view, uniformly bad, right? They were all sort of very aggressive platitudes, of which both leaders were able to deal with very easily. But one person went, are you willing to put public safety over human rights? Which obviously I, as a wet liberal, found deeply irritating. And obviously Corbyn did a, with my extreme bias, than anyone who answers this question in favour of the human rights angle, I will immediately go 10 points. Corbyn, I thought, did it very well. But actually, Boris Johnson, I thought, dealt with it very well in his immediate answer, and was quite unwilling, it felt to me, to occupy the, you know, hang 'em and flog 'em position that he knows, and, you know, his choice of Home Secretary indicates he knows he ought to be in. And it was quite striking, because obviously, you know, the thing which has typified Boris Johnson's leadership is a willingness to abandon positions he has held previously to win. And it's always, to me at least, interesting when you discover what someone's internal red lines are. And it seemed that we discovered tonight that one of his red lines isn't, he isn't quite willing to go, of course, I will put public safety over human rights.
Now let's break down the various topics in tonight's debate. As Stephen touched on there, it did seem as though with relative ease, Boris Johnson managed to move most questions back to Brexit, and Jeremy Corbyn managed to move a lot of questions back to the cost of living. Let's start with Brexit. Now, Boris Johnson, we know, is happiest discussing Brexit, happiest saying those three words, get Brexit done, and he did that at many opportunities, multiple times tonight. However, it is Jeremy Corbyn who often has a harder time there. James, did you feel that Jeremy Corbyn was helped slightly from the release of the document early today by Labour, which suggested that Boris Johnson's being fairly loose with the truth on checks on the Irish border in terms of an Irish sea border? Did you think that it meant that Jeremy Corbyn sounded more confident about his position?
I mean, the problem with Jeremy Corbyn talking about Northern Ireland is he is leading with his chin because of his previous sympathy for the IRA, and Boris Johnson predictably dinged him on that during the debate, pointing out he wasn't going to take any lectures from Jeremy Corbyn on the issue of the union in Northern Ireland, given Corbyn's, what Boris Johnson called Corbyn's past support for the IRA. I have to say, I thought tonight Boris Johnson was quite effective in example of how repetition can be effective. You know, at every point in the debate, he said, we're now 10 minutes into the debate and we still don't know where Jeremy Corbyn stands on Brexit. Then he was like, we're 20 minutes into the debate and we still don't know where Jeremy Corbyn stands.
I think
stands
we got up to 40 minutes, didn't we?
And it just, and we didn't actually, to be fair to Boris, we didn't actually get an answer all the way through the debate. And he did drive that point home relentlessly. And I think there's an interesting question here. One of the things the Tories are utterly convinced by is that Corbyn's position of neutrality on Brexit hurts him. I think Jeremy Corbyn actually does a fairly good job of explaining why he wants to stay neutral. But, you know, the country is too divided, there needs to be some coming together. But I do think in terms of brutal politics, Boris Johnson is very effective at hammering him on that point.
Stephen, one of the issues for the Conservatives in the past week or so has been that the Liberal Democrat vote has been going down and some of their peers have been going to Labour. Now, logic would suggest that if Lib Dem voters, those who are not completely opposed to Jeremy Corbyn to such a degree they can't even entertain the possibility of him and 10 Downing Street, if Lib Dem voters who ultimately feel very pro the EU, passionate about it, make the calculation that a vote for Labour is their best way to get to a second referendum, it could spell trouble for the Tories over the next couple of days leading up to Thursday. Do you think Jeremy Corbyn's pitch in that debate, where he spoke at several times about why he thought a referendum was the best plan for the country and will win him some more votes in that group?
Yeah, I mean, I think we know that the known unknown in this election is how big is the size of the group of Lib Dem voters who just will not vote for Labour in its current form, and is it small enough that they can take all of the rest and get a hung parliament? And I think he basically did everything you need to do to win over those people. He had a strong answer on civil liberties over security. He spoke about the needs of the need to have another referendum, but also crucially, he's not Boris Johnson, and people understand how our electoral system works. And by agreeing to these two debates, the risk the Conservatives have taken is that there are enough people who, when you... Because, you know, we saw this in the run-up to the debate with the BBC going, oh, well, Joe Swinson's not even here. What Boris Johnson, the BBC and ITV have handed to Corbyn is a live television demonstration that he is the lever to pull if you want to stop Boris Johnson. Now, we know that for some people that lever is so repellent that they can't bring themselves to pull it, even as they find the prospect of another Conservative government emotionally painful to them. But I think he basically did everything you'd need to do to get everyone who doesn't find it emotionally painful, or the people who are torn about finding it emotionally painful, to pull the red lever.
Now let's talk about domestic issues and spending. That was a topic for discussion where the four-day working week came up, something which has been the subject of, I would say, some mockery and also quite a lot of conversation on at least our daily podcast over the past couple of weeks. Jeremy Corbyn was asked specifically about the four-day working week, and he appeared, James, at least from where I was sitting, to perform a slight change of position to at least what some in his party had said. So then they're talking about NHS staffing, nurses. It was a question about what each party would do to help nurses. He suggested that it was not the case a four-day working week would apply to NHS staff. Now, John McDonnell did suggest in a press conference where Jonathan Ashworth, the Shadow Health Secretary, looked slightly alarmed that it would apply to this group. Do you think that was a purposeful rollback, or is that just not being on top of what everyone in your Shadow Cabinet has said?
I think the four-day week, if the Tories win a majority of this election, one of the moments we will write about, I think, is the Labour announcement of the four-day week policy at their conference. Because when they announced it, the Tories were not certain how the public would react to it. There was a lot of nervousness that this might be like some of Labour's 2017 giveaways. It might strike a chord. The public don't buy it. The public essentially think the idea that they can work for 4 days a week and get paid the same as if they work for five doesn't work. And the Tories have used it quite effectively to kind of neutralise some of Labour's attacks on the NHS. And I think tonight you did see Jeremy Corbyn move further away from it than they had previously. This now appears to be a Labour idea of a kind of John Lennon song lyric, imagine only working 4 days a week, rather than an actual, and we will begin this policy and it will be implemented at this point and at this time. So I think that definitely was a shift in Labour's position on that four-day week question.
Now, Boris Johnson was asked about his own costings in terms of the manifesto, Stephen, and the point was made by Nick Robinson that ultimately Boris Johnson had promised a solution on social care. No details of that, no idea of cost, along with a few other aspects. So why is it that actually the Conservatives can own this high ground on the economy? Do you think, if we think about, I suppose, fiscal rules, if we think about fiscal competence, there is a potential issue for the Conservatives in this election? Or actually, is it really a positive for them and it, the attack is on Labour?
So, with the massive caveat that obviously what I'm about to say could turn out to be humiliatingly wrong in 5 days' time, I just think, in the same way that it doesn't matter how that there are more calories in a Pret Christmas sandwich than there are in a Big Mac. Pret is the healthy brand, McDonald's are the fast food brand. Labour are the generous brand. It does not matter how many times the Tories say we've run the NHS for most of its existence. They're the ones who aren't trusted on it. Ditto, it doesn't matter that the Conservatives... I'm sorry, their fiscal plans are just incoherent, right? No one could look at them and give that a passing grade. You could similarly say that Labour's fiscal plans are incoherent. But the Conservatives are the mean, fiscally tough party, and Labour are the generous, profligate party. And I just think that it doesn't matter that the Conservatives have got quite an incoherent spending plan, because their brand isn't they don't. And so I think they'll be fine.
Now, another topic that was discussed was both of the parties' weaknesses in terms of discrimination, in terms of forms of racism, and that was on anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. James, first to you, to me at least, didn't seem as though Boris Johnson was perhaps engaging in the most serious way on these questions, because he managed to pivot both of them back to Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was perhaps the most striking, if it would be a kind word, example of Boris Johnson's ability to shift the conversation back to get Brexit done, whatever the question was. I think this actually illustrates something kind of slightly deeply depressing about the state of our politics at the moment, which is that you would think an election in which the chief rabbi had essentially said to non-Jews, please don't vote for Labour, I don't think I'm overly crudely paraphrasing when he said, please don't vote, you know, vote your conscience and vote to keep our community safe, and we don't think Labour would. You would think this question should be very easy for the Tories, but I think one of the things, I don't think the issue of Islamophobia in the Tory party is the same as the issue of anti-Semitism in the Labour party, and I don't think people at the top of the Tory party are trying to actively protect Islamophobes in the same way I think you're seeing that happen in the Labour party. But it is also quite clear that for all the Tory talk of people being out on the first bounce if they say Islamophobic things or things that express prejudice against Islam as a religion, that is not quite true. And I think that is, I thought it was depressing that both sides basically want to get away from this question as quickly as possible. That is not a particularly impressive state of affairs.
Stephen, on anti-Semitism, it certainly felt as though Jeremy Corbyn was more apologetic and more willing to engage on the topic than in his Andrew Neil interview.
Yeah, I think he does now have a form of words than he, you know, and yeah, lots of people who have been on the forefront of fighting against anti-Semitism in the Labour Party would say that they felt that his form of words was not wholly accurate, but he does have a form of words and he's now willing to say.
And finally, a question which managed to throw at least one politician off guard came near the end of the episode, and that was when a lady in the audience asked both leaders what punishment they thought politicians who lied during elections deserved, and we can listen to the clip here.
Well, they should be made to go on their knees through the chamber of the House of Commons, scourging themselves with copies of their offending documents, which claim to prove one thing and actually prove something quite different.
Stephen, Boris Johnson seemed slightly lost for words there, didn't he? And if anything, sounded a bit embarrassed as he tried to joke his way through that.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's ultimately a politician who needs to be loved, right? Yeah, and you can see this actually in the House of Commons when he takes a sympathetic question, particularly when he was taking it from one of the ones who he had ultimately given the whip back. You could feel him almost wanting to come over and bring them towards him. And this is an issue where his own unpopularity, which we kind of neglect because Corbyn's unpopularity is so much greater even than his, is sort of brought sort of front and centre. I sat in on a focus group recently in which the person running the session asked them all to write down in their groups three words to do with Boris Johnson. And they all chorused liar. And she went, no, I want you to do it privately. And I think that's one of the reasons why he struggles with it, because it is a visible symbol of the fact that, yes, if the polls are right, he's going to go to quite a heavy victory. But he is not now. and will never be the kind of much-loved Sun King of London.
Yes, James, if you listen to Boris Johnson's reply there, it got, I think, a singular clap, maybe two or three people clapping. And then Jeremy Corbyn came in and sounded much more sombre in his answer, talking about holding the government to account and how, you know, these things couldn't be joked around. And that received quite a reasonable, I think, round of applause. Do you think this is Boris Johnson's weakest spot in terms of this campaign?
Well, Katie, as you've been saying, kind of trust is the biggest issue for Boris Johnson's election. And I think, ironically, this was the question where he should have pivoted straight away to getting Brexit done. Because I think, we can argue about the precise veracity of lots of Boris Johnson's statements, but there is no doubt that in the 2017 election, the vast majority of MPs stood on a personal and a party platform that they would respect the referendum result and that Brexit would happen. We are having this election because two and a bit years on, people have not honoured that commitment. And I think if he had made that point in response, he could have turned the trust question around to his own advantage. And I think in a way, his demeanour was a bit kind of shamefacedly,
it's quite sheepish, wasn't it?
Jokey. And I think he actually would have been much better to have gone on the offensive on that question. So look, the biggest fib told at the last election was in 2017, Jeremy Corbyn stood on the manifesto saying he would respect the referendum result. He now stands before you tonight promising a second referendum. And I think that is the mistake that he made in answering that question. There is a way that he can turn the trust question to the Tories' advantage, but he's not doing it confidently enough.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you for listening.